What do you think about that? Is that the right thing for governmental affairs to be doing under your supervision?
It is not. It is not. And if you look at Category I, you know, a lot of those names came from government relations. Government relations reports to me, and I think it should not have been that way. I mean, fundamentally, we just have to get people out of this admissions process. So the answer is it shouldn't have been. Now, having said that, I have no doubt that the people involved, including Mr. McLennan, who's, you know, he's devoted to the University of Illinois, his supervisor, Rick Schell, is an outstanding man, just retiring now. I have no doubt that Terry felt he was doing what was best for the University of Illinois in advocating for candidates who had sponsors, legislative sponsors.
Did you know that he was doing it before the Tribune report?
I did not. I did not.
Yet, no knowledge.
I did not. I know that the legislators give very high marks to Mr. Schell, Mr. McLennan, their responsiveness. I always interpreted that as being courteous, getting right back to them, etc. I think the dividing line is, and I read those emails. I think the dividing line was crossed in getting into advocacy. That's getting into the admissions decision, I think that shouldn't have happened.
Herman knew about it. Chancellor Herman knew about it. And the person who answered directly to you, Schell,
yes.
Rick Schell, knew all about it.
Mm-hmm.
Those two men knew about it, but you didn't know about it.
I did not know there was active advocacy for individual candidates in the admissions process by government relations.
President,
that's true.
President White, you acknowledged before that every inquiry is advocacy.
Yes, it is.
Well, how do you feel about the fact that governmental relations had so many inquiries? Didn't that worry you a little bit? Did you know how many inquiries they had?
Well, I didn't know how many inquiries there were. You know, I have to say, I wish I had known. I wish I had known about Category I. I wish I had seen the list that I've now gone through with Mr. Marshall. I wish that I had known that the about the degree of advocacy. Yes, I wish that.
What did you say to Marshall when he sits down in front of you with a list, you know, close to 200 names, and they've got a name, they've got a whole system? What did you say to him?
Well, first I have to say, it was no, and I said this immediately when this story broke, it was no surprise to me that there was a list. There are many lists in the university. Every dean has a list of people who are inquiries that are made. And I said, that, you know, those are forms of advocacy. I was not surprised there were, you know, flagged applications have been around a long time. I was not surprised. What surprised me was the reversal of presumptive denials.
How would you feel about a policy, a university policy that said that admissions has a firewall around it that excludes a lot of people, and particularly governmental relations, that they don't talk to admissions people, because even those inquiries, those innocent inquiries you talk about, really are advocacy, aren't they?
Well, yes. I think much has come to light as a result of the documents that have come forth in your own investigation and things we've learned through our examination. One of the things I think is that we need a code of conduct covering admission from top to bottom in the university. But I'd like to be very direct with this commission. I want to say this to you. If I could boil the code of conduct down to one thing, it would be this. I think our policy should be for everybody above the dean level to get the heck out of admissions. And I think that also applies to sideways organizations, government affairs, development, happy to talk about that. Because I think that you know, we're not creating policy for every public university in the country. This is the University of Illinois. And we're going through a really difficult thing here. And I think what's been lost is I feel terrible that the University of Illinois' reputation has been tarnished by what's happened here. And I feel terrible that there's been a loss of confidence by the people of Illinois in the fairness and the objectivity of our process. And job one is to restore it. That is job one.
So
we have to do whatever is required.
What are you going to do?
Well, we've shared some ideas with the commission, but I think we need to be respectful and listen to the commission's recommendations to us with a presumption of embracing them. But if it were just my decision, Commissioner Scott, the code of conduct regarding admissions would say exactly what I just said. Admissions will be managed across the university by people charged with admissions. Nobody above the dean level will have any involvement. There will be no involvement by government relations and no involvement by development. That's what I want to do.
Did you ever advocate a more robust code of conduct in the past?
No, I have to say, it did not occur to me that we would need a code of conduct for admissions.
Mm-hmm. Because the trustees say that they went to you, I believe, and you just referred them to the chancellor when they had questions about admissions. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
I think that the trustees most time trustees went directly to the chancellor.
Well, they were looking to you for direction. And mm-hmm. How do we handle these? Mm-hmm. And you said, take them to the chancellor. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, as President Stuckel said, the chancellors are the CEOs of the campuses. Admissions mm-hmm. occurs at the campus level. Having said that, though, I want to be direct. I do not recall a trustee saying to me, I have an admissions issue, what should I do? Mm-hmm. And my saying, go to the chancellor. I don't recall happening.
Did you ever view it as your role to give the trustees guidance on how to handle these things in an ethical way?
I did not think that unethical things were occurring in admissions. I mean, you know, the well-known instance of Mr. Epley communicating to me the governor's office interest in two candidates, to me that was not unethical. You know, I'd like us to create a situation where that doesn't happen. But I didn't think it was unethical. It didn't occur to me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and where does it cross the line?
I think what's sacred is the admissions decision process. Mm-hmm. What's sacred is the admissions decision process. I think that those who make admissions decisions need guidance, which is by and large what deans give. Deans, on behalf of the faculty, give guidance about admission criteria. Admissions people then make those judgments. Occasionally, and I found this as a dean, when they had a question about a case, they'd come, as people do with their supervisor, and confer with you and say, you know, this is a tough one. What do you think? And I think that's fine. That's why I say deans cannot be excluded from admissions process, in my view. But beyond that, nobody else should be involved, I believe, now, given what we've been through. And when admissions decisions are made, they need to be final unless there was a demonstrable error.
Why do you think no one came to you and said, we have a problem here? The line is being crossed on a regular basis.
I've really pondered that, and I think it really bothers me. When I met with Keith Marshall, I asked him. You hear some agonizing. You've heard some agonizing by people who felt that, you know, this really, they weren't comfortable with it, et cetera. And, you know, I'm on videotape to the university community on behalf of the university auditors saying, you know, the most important thing is ethical conduct. And if in doubt, raise it. Don't sit in silence. And so I wish people had come to me. I really wish the chancellor had come to me. I wish Dean Hurd had come to me. Mr. Pless had come to say, you know, we think what we're doing is right here, but it doesn't really feel quite right, and what can we do about it? Mm-hmm. I really wish that had happened. I think they were looking at a lot of hierarchy above them that seemed to be participating. You know, let's be honest. They saw trustee names. They saw my name, right, on inquiries.
Right, that's right.
They saw chancellor, so, et cetera. So I think, and Mr. Marshall said, and I think he's an extremely honest man and a great admissions officer, he said, well, we thought this is what you all wanted.
Right. And by the way, this is why I have a problem with the strict hierarchy described by President Stuckel this morning, because for exactly this reason.
So I understand you correctly that in what you hope will come out of these reforms and changes at the university, that in the future the chancellor of a particular campus, whether it's at Urbana or wherever, will only get involved in admissions if it's a matter of policy. Is that correct?
Right.
And that on individual cases, the chancellor is no longer the go-to guy.
It's exactly right. And two other things. I was a dean for 10 years. I don't ever recall hearing from the president of the university or a provost, my boss, about admissions matters. So I can tell you they'll work fine to leave admissions to deans and admissions officers. Judge and commissioners, the other thing I want to say is this. Conventional wisdom is that you can't do what I just said, which is tell everybody to get the heck out of admissions above the level of dean and in development and so on. Because, you know, you've already heard this argument. You know, we'll disadvantage ourselves when it comes to fundraising. Here's what I think. I think that in the midst of this very painful episode, there's an opportunity for the University of Illinois to challenge conventional wisdom and take a leadership position. Because I think that if our policy, and of course we'll put nice words around it, essentially says everybody above the level of dean, get the heck out, and that applies to you, government relations, which reports to me, and development, which I'm deeply involved in, I think that within a year we will know whether conventional wisdom is right, and we've really hurt ourselves in terms of donations and how legislators feel about it, et cetera. My forecast, because I've dealt with a lot of conventional wisdom in my management career, is sometimes it's right, but it's often not. And I have a feeling that if we do this and the results are fine, and as I think President Eikenberry said, we'll garner more respect from the public for having an objective, untrammeled process. I think other public universities will say, geez, we really didn't know we could do that. Let's do it.
You know, in my experience, when people are afraid to complain up the chain of command, it's because they fear retribution. Do you think these people had any fear of retribution? Is that the reason they didn't come forward?
I think that's a good hypothesis. I can't speak for them, but it's always a good hypothesis, of course.
Could you go into a little more detail? Has anybody been fired for complaining about the chancellor?
Not to my knowledge, no.
I have some broader questions before you get to the detail, if that's okay. Could you describe your current ethics and compliance program?
We have an ethics officer at the University of Illinois, Donna McNeely, who reports to me. She has multiple duties, one of the most important being to design now and to deliver ethics training to over 45,000 people. We have about 25,000 employees, members of the university community who are employed by us, but about 45,000 have to take ethics training. So Donna does that. Complaints of any kind can go from anywhere in the community can go to Ms. McNeely as a first line. In terms of compliance, the University of Illinois, there were discussions this morning about the negatives of being a quote-unquote state agency. There are also positives about being a state agency. We comply with the state's procurement code, for example, which I think is really good in terms of maintaining objectivity, arm's length, best price, et cetera. So we comply with all of the state's many, many policies involving potential conflicts of interest, conflicts of commitment. We have a substantial university audit staff led by Julie Zimaitis, who reports to me. They do an extensive annual audit program. I think that there are many, many reminders of our responsibilities for ethical conduct and means to monitor compliance. And yet, having said that, and this happens in organizational life and is very disappointing, you know, I think we have here a matter that could have and should have been seen more in ethical terms, and yet it wasn't.
How many staff members does Ms. McNeely have?
I think three.
She has three. Would you consider enlarging her staff as a result of this?
Of course.
Issue. Did she ever receive a complaint about Category I or selective?
Not to my knowledge, and because Ms. McNeely reports to me, I believe I would know if she had.
Were the trustees among those who were trained, with the 45,000 people she trained, did she ever train?
Yes, the trustees do take the annual ethics training.
Okay, so all the trustees, including the current trustees, are familiar with the conflict of interest prohibition?
I believe that's the case.
And you are as well,
yes,
correct?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how long ago did that start with the trustees? In other words, was there a period in time in which any of the trustees served in which that prohibition on conflicts of interest did not apply?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr.
John? Thank you, Judge. Let me just briefly go back to your Michigan experience. You testified that at Michigan, the vast majority of inquiries that you received with regard to admissions in your position as dean were from the donor community and the alumni community.
Correct.
When you came to Illinois, did you experience the same distribution of inquiries across those populations, or did you observe something different?